KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It just can't fight everything. So if it catches here, if something, an ember or something catches here, that's it.
In Los Angeles, some people are packing essentials, dragging duffel bags down flights of stairs as they evacuate from wildfires.
For Thursday, January 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, as fires burn around Los Angeles, residents are making checklists of what to take and planning evacuation routes.
Got in the car and said goodbye to my house, and I'm hoping that when I return, there will be a house there.
Also, in an exit interview with CIA Director Bill Burns, I asked about relations with an incoming president who has criticized U.S. spy agencies.
My hope, at least, is that in this new administration, that people will understand the significance of good intelligence.
And the physics of hula hooping.
That's ahead. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As several Southern California wildfires continue to rage, President Joe Biden has detailed what the federal government is going to do to help with the response. More from NPR's Lexi Schapitl.
President Biden said the federal government is sending 400 firefighters, nearly 40 firefighting helicopters and planes, and 500 ground-clearing personnel to Southern California. He also said he had approved funding to cover costs of fire management, debris removal, and first responder salaries for 180 days. But he said Congress will need to allocate more funds for the response efforts.
We're going to be going back to Congress asking for some more help on some of this stuff. And I hope they're ready to step up.
Biden also said that lack of power, which was shut off in some cases to prevent sparking more fires, was to blame for some hydrants in the area running dry. Some Republicans have accused local Democratic officials of mismanaging the water supply. Lexi Schapitl, NPR News, Washington.
With the number of structures damaged or destroyed by the California wildfires rising to between 4,000 and 5,000, many people are returning to their homes to find nothing but charred ruins. NPR's Frank Langford spoke with one homeowner.
Jingwan Leo Turvalon had a modest one-story house in Altadena, a small pool. When she left Tuesday night, she thought she'd be back the next day.
So we packed our documents, we packed the kids' artwork, and we packed one night worth of clothes.
On Wednesday, her son Sam drove back to pick up more possessions.
It was entirely burned to the ground. And I was just stunned, absolutely stunned.
Gone are the photos and pictures on the walls and the entire block.
I keep on waking up at night thinking, oh my God, how did I not anticipate this?
Leo Turvalon says she's not certain if her family will rebuild here. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
The Supreme Court has rejected President-elect Donald Trump's request to stop his sentencing in the New York hush money case scheduled for tomorrow. As NPR's Amanda Bastillo reports, this was Trump's final attempt to delay the criminal sentencing.
The court said that any concerns Trump has about the case should first be litigated through, quote, ordinary course on appeal or through lower courts. The justices also said that sentencing will inflict a relatively light burden on him since New York Judge Juan Merchan intends to impose a sentence of unconditional discharge, meaning Trump will not face prison, probation, or any fines. The conviction will, however, remain on his records. Conservative justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh would have sided with Trump in halting the sentencing. That means Trump was just one person shy of having a majority of the court agree with him. The decision means Trump will become the first former or sitting president to be convicted and sentenced on criminal charges after he was found guilty of falsifying business records. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, New York.
U.S. financial markets were closed today due to the National Day of Mourning for former President Jimmy Carter. You're listening to NPR. One organization in Sacramento, California has been dedicated to helping black students with disabilities get the school services they are legally entitled to. Cap Radio's Shishti Prabha has more.
Parent Malik faced an uphill battle trying to advocate for her son's school needs after he was diagnosed with autism.
Even though I'm aware of what rights my son had, it seemed like there was always a fight for it, and I always felt outnumbered.
Malik's son now has a 3.8 GPA. After being directed to a school that has the resources to support him, she credits the Black Parallel School Board, a Sacramento-based community organization that helps families navigate school systems. In 2019, the board sued the school district, saying black students with disabilities were being disproportionately segregated and disciplined. In 2023, they reached a settlement, and the district said they were working to be, quote, more inclusive and less punitive. For NPR News, I'm Srishti Prabha in Sacramento.
A spacecraft launched by the European Space Agency and Japan has beamed back some of the closest photos ever of the planet Mercury's north pole. Pictures released today by the European Space Agency show the permanently shadowed craters at the top of the solar system's smallest innermost planet. It was the sixth flyby of Mercury by the BepiColombo spacecraft since it was first launched in 2018. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today as colder winter weather in the U.S. and Europe was expected to drive up demand for heating fuel, oil up 60 cents a barrel to $73.92 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We begin this hour in Los Angeles, where close to 200,000 people remain under mandatory evacuation orders as out-of-control wildfires continue to threaten homes and lives. Kirk Sigler is one of our many NPR colleagues on the ground in L.A., moving around the city to give us as full a sense of what is unfolding there as we can bring you. Right now, he's in Pacific Palisades by the Pacific Coast Highway. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So we're now 3 days into this. Are conditions getting any better?
Well, I do have some good news to report, and the big thing here is that the wind has died down, and in fact, you can feel a little bit of humidity, and that's a sense that the wind patterns have shifted back coming off the Pacific, and humidity is key, as is the fact that there's no wind, and in fact, or very little wind, and in fact, that's allowing air attack of the fire. And as I've been standing here on the PCH, scoopers have been dipping into the Pacific Ocean. It's just an extraordinary sight. Two at a time and flying up onto the Santa Monica Mountains, which you can see now for the first time in 2 days.
Wow.
And dropping salt water on the flames. So conditions are getting a little bit better, certainly not the wind we've had in recent days.
I'm glad to hear conditions are maybe starting to improve a little bit, but give us a sense of the scale of destruction that you have seen or from people you've been talking to.
Well, this is, you know, it's huge. And I'm just in Pacific Palisades. There's a lot of homes that have been burned. I've been looking at a hotel down the highway here that's completely leveled. You know, there has been a lot of attention on cable news in particular showing images of high dollar homes burning along the coastline here. You certainly see that, but good opportunity to really stress Los Angeles is a huge city, Mary Louise. There is a lot of need here. You can hear actually the air tanker come over me right now, the scooper that is, but there's a lot of need here. And it's an economically diverse place. Even here on the more affluent west side, a lot of people in crisis. I met Lisa France. She had just gotten a cell phone alert that we all did in the northern part of Santa Monica, saying it was now a mandatory evacuation. She lives in a second floor walk-up in a 70-year-old apartment building in Santa Monica. You're about to hear she's on crutches because she's recovering from a surgery. And she told me, you know, she just had already packed her essentials. Let's hear a little now.
But, you know, you can't take everything. You just can't. But it teaches you a lesson. It's like the things that you absolutely have to have, you look around and you think, well, I guess I don't need the rest of this.
So we're right in the middle of the city here, Santa Monica.
Yes, right in the middle.
These are neighbors?
These are neighbors, yeah. He's my neighbor, and he and his wife live right in the building. I've seen what they do. You know, there's just not enough resources, and they just can't fight everything. So if it catches here, if something, an ember or something catches here, that's it.
Mary Louise, as you can hear, people are very nervous and on edge.
And just very briefly, Kirk, does the LA Fire Department, do they have the resources they need now?
I think it's safe to say resources are pouring in. I mean, even as I've been talking to you right now on this turnout here in the burn zone, lots of fire trucks have come in and they're staging right above me. I can see, it looks like trees on fire from embers. There's still homes on fire above us from spot fires, and it's still a very active situation, but there are more resources on the ground. But, you know, in the end, with 100 mile an hour winds this week, like, there's just not a lot that can be done to try to stop a fire or fires like these.
And NPR's Kirk Sigler, as you heard, right in the thick of it there in LA. Thank you, Kirk.
You're welcome.
The stories you hear about migrants trying to reach Europe and smugglers' boats are often about tragedy. Thousands drown while making the dangerous journey, but today we can tell you a different story about a baby girl born at sea on an overcrowded rubber dinghy and rescued with her mother. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has this report.
Domingo Trujillo, the captain of the ship that rescued the migrants from the smugglers' boat, says he'd been told there was a heavily pregnant woman on board. He didn't expect what happened next. The surprise was that we found a totally naked baby who was born 10, 15, or 20 minutes earlier, he says. Trujillo gave this interview to Spanish state television, TVE. He says he held the baby to his chest for warmth and patted them to calm them. Spain's sea rescue service, Salvamento Marítimo, published a photo of the rescue, showing the naked newborn baby girl surrounded by migrants in the small, overcrowded boat that had over 60 people on board. They were found in the Atlantic Ocean, trying to reach Spain's Canary Islands from West Africa. Helena Maleno, a spokesperson for the aid organization Caminando Fronteras, or Walking Borders, says this has become the deadliest route for migrants in the world. A new report by the group finds that over 9,000 migrants died last year trying to reach the Canary Islands by sea. La desestabilización de la zona del Sahel, el reclutamiento... Maleno says the war in the Sahel, forced recruitment into paramilitary groups, human trafficking and climate change are among the reasons for this displacement. In 2024, almost 47,000 migrants reached the Canary Islands, according to data from Spain's Interior Ministry. The baby girl born on the migrant ship was born during Spain's Epiphany holiday, when children traditionally receive presents in honor of the biblical story about the three kings who visited baby Jesus. The pilot of the helicopter that took the baby and her mum to the nearby island of Lanzarote for treatment told the news agency Reuters that, being Three Kings Day, this was the best gift we could have received. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Tomorrow in Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro is set to be sworn in for a third term. Now, this despite disputed results from the election this past July, which opposition leader Edmundo Gonzalez says he won by a landslide. Gonzalez left Venezuela for Spain. He has been in exile, and he spent these last few days traveling to shore up international support. This week, he met with President Biden, and now he says he will travel to Venezuela to be sworn in, despite a warrant for his arrest and a $100,000 bounty on his head. Raul Stolk is the managing director of the news site Caracas Chronicles, which covers Venezuelan politics. I spoke with him earlier this afternoon to talk through what's going on. So it sounds like we're looking at this showdown tomorrow. Two politicians, Nicolas Maduro, who many believe stole the election, and Edmundo Gonzalez, who's vowed to challenge the inauguration at what sounds like great personal risk. Set the stage for us a little bit more about what the atmosphere is like in Venezuela.
Well, right now, in the moment that we're doing this interview, there's a lot of stuff going on because the opposition called for a protest today. Maria Corina Machado, she's the one who has like the political capital in the opposition leadership.
Mm-hmm. And Gonzalez's fellow opposition leader, yeah.
Yes, Machado has been in hiding for several months. She's in Venezuela and she appeared in the protest today. The thing is that right now, as we're speaking, there is she went to the protest, she gave a speech. There was a lot of police and military presence around the area where the protest was taking place. And I have reports of the Maduro's intelligence police trying to get close to her, people blocking them. But as she left, we have some information that she was intercepted.
So let me fill in a little bit more context here for Americans trying to keep up. We're talking about two opposition leaders, Gonzalez, who ran in the election and says he won, Machado, who, as you mentioned, is if anything, a larger presence in Venezuelan politics. I actually interviewed her in November. She was, as you say, in hiding. This development today, she left her hideout for the first time in months. She joined the protests. And it sounds like there are reports that she's been intercepted. You don't know yet exactly what has happened there.
Yes.
So into all of this, Gonzalez says he is going to show up tomorrow to actually contest the inauguration. How likely is it that that will happen, that he'll even be able to get back into the country?
Well, there is a warrant for the arrest of Gonzalez, and this reward, that this $100,000 reward, that's basically a, kind of a propaganda device. They put banners all over the city with a wanted poster. But I don't think that they want to be in the position to actually take him in. What I think that they will do is look for ways to block his access to the country.
I know you have colleagues spread out in Venezuela trying to cover all of this. What are they hearing from people? What is the conversation? Is it hope? Is it confusion? Is it despair?
I do believe, and I've seen surveys where at least 70% of Venezuelans think that something positive is going to come out of this, that this is like the first step toward a transition. And well, 70% of Venezuelans is basically what voted against Maduro. So I would say that the opposition leadership has, even in this complicated situation, has been able to keep the support steady.
That was Raul Stolk, the managing director of the news site Caracas Chronicles, talking us through dramatic political developments in Venezuela. Thank you.
Thank you for this interview.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. At this precise moment in the Northern Virginia suburbs of Washington, we are about to hang a right off this main road and pull up to the front gates of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. We are here to interview the director.
Steve, have a meeting with the director?
Yes.
Stand by.
That would be Bill Burns. Elsewhere on the show today, you'll hear me question him on the wars in Ukraine and the Middle East, also what he calls the rising threat posed by ISIS. As Bill Burns prepares to step aside after 4 years running the CIA, we also asked how the agency is preparing to serve an incoming president, Donald Trump, with a well-documented history of attacking his intelligence chiefs. That's in a moment. First, another pressing priority, China, and the recent cyber attack by China into U.S. phone companies, the Salt Typhoon attack. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, who chairs the Intelligence Committee, has called it, and I quote, the worst telecom hack in our nation's history by far. Is it?
Oh, I have great respect for Senator Warner, and I think he's right to highlight the seriousness of this concern. It's something that we're still in the process of, you know, understanding the breadth of it as well. It's a reminder not to underestimate the Chinese services and their determination in the case of Salt Typhoon and U.S. telecom companies, but also what's called Vault Typhoon, which was an effort to penetrate critical infrastructure. And so, you know, it's not in our interest to underestimate Chinese capability or determination on these issues.
Is it the start of something new? Would you describe this? Because China, I think it's fair to say, has been seen as active in cyber attacks, but messier than some other actors, not the most sophisticated. Does this strike you as a new level of sophistication that they're able to do this?
This is pretty sophisticated, yeah. And it's a reminder of what they're capable of. And it's a further reminder of one of the most significant priorities in this agency over the last 4 years, which has been to, you know, invest in long-term priorities, People's Republic of China being one, the revolution in technology being a second, because it's technology that's the main arena for competition with China. So we formed a new China Mission Center, the only single country mission center that we have at this agency. We've tripled the budget at CIA for the China target across the whole CIA. It's now about 20% of the overall CIA budget. So it's a reflection of the fact that we realize the challenge ahead. And, you know, this is one of those moments of, I think, revolutionary change on the international landscape with intense major power competition with China and with Russia, but also a revolution in technology, and like anything we've seen since the Industrial Revolution. What that means for us at CIA and has meant over the last 4 years is that we have to begin to revolutionize the practice of intelligence.
So I do want to ask about the transition, because the last time this particular president-elect transitioned in, Donald Trump had spent the campaign ridiculing and attacking the leaders of the intelligence community. He was sworn into office having just compared U.S. intelligence agencies to Nazis. How's that going this time around? How would it compare to this time around?
Well, I've had a couple of conversations with my successor, or at least the CIA director designee, John Ratcliffe, and I promised him that we would ensure the smoothest possible transition here. I stressed to him that this is an apolitical institution, that I was confident that, you know, my colleagues here, for whom I have the deepest respect and admiration, would show him what CIA was capable of, just as they showed me what CIA is capable of. And so we'll continue to work hard at that, because that's not only what I owe the women and men of CIA, but I think that's what's going to serve American interests the best, too.
I mean, I'm asking in part because the relationship, if anything, deteriorated from there and led to the famous moment in Helsinki where the U.S. commander-in-chief suggested he believed Vladimir Putin over his own intelligence community. Did you, Bill Burns, ever figure out why?
No, I didn't figure out why. And my hope, at least, is that in this new administration that people will understand, the significance of good intelligence for any national security, goals that the new administration wants to set, and to understand the reality that this is an apolitical institution, made up of men and women who are patriotic, who are deeply committed to the best interests of this country. And if you trust them and respect them, they'll produce amazing things.
I'm just going to push you on this because you are a Russia expert and a past U.S. ambassador in Moscow. You never figured out why Donald Trump was so deferential to Vladimir Putin.
No, I mean, that's not something, and, I've commented on that in the past before I was back in government, but it's not something I'm going to offer opinions about today.
Okay. On briefings, has Trump asked for daily intelligence briefings? Is he getting them?
There have been. I mean, these are managed by the Director of National Intelligence, by my friend Avril Haines, and there have been several briefings, and certainly CIA officers contribute to them.
Same format as Joe Biden gets?
Same in terms of the PDB, at least the president's daily brief, which is, what's the basis for the briefings for President-elect Trump as well.
And you mentioned John Ratcliffe, who, if confirmed by the Senate, will succeed you in this office on the seventh floor of headquarters. What have your conversations with him been like?
Oh, very straightforward. I think he's been curious about, what's transpired in the intelligence community since he was the Director of National Intelligence in the last year of the first Trump administration. And, very focused on what our priorities have been, especially on China and on technology issues as well. And I, look forward to further conversations with him before the 20th of January.
Let me start to bring us full circle by asking a question I asked you when you started this job, because I'm curious if your answer has changed. Given everything we've just been talking about, all the threats that you have to be across at all hours of the day and night, what does keep you awake at night?
That was a good question 4 years ago. It still is now. I mean, honestly, the thing that concerns me the most is risk to my officers. I can, and the senior leadership here can mitigate risk, it can try to anticipate, it can try to prevent it. But, I have a lot of colleagues who are doing really hard jobs in really hard places right now, and I can't make risk go away. And every morning I walk by our memorial wall, in the lobby of headquarters with 140 stars on the wall, which are a vivid reminder of the sacrifices that CIA officers make. And so that's something that is bound to keep me up at night.
What do you have planned for the afternoon of January 20th?
Probably sleep. I mean, there are lots of things that, I haven't done over the last 4 years. I have three wonderful brothers, and we had a tradition for 20 years of going to the first round of the NCAA men's, basketball tournament in March. And so this year I'm determined to actually get there with the three of them.
There we go. From the CIA to March Madness.
That's true. Yeah.
Bill Burns. For a few more days, he is director of the CIA.
Nice to see you, Mary Louise. Thank you very much.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
We've heard the stories of the Southern California wildfires from the people who have lived in the path of the flames. We'll continue to bring you the latest coverage tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, our science news roundup from the team at NPR Shortwave Podcast.
This week, we dig into the physics of hula hooping.
If you watch someone hula hoop, they barely twitch. It's almost imperceivable. And yet, that's enough to bring this big hoop all the way around.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Catastrophic wildfires driven by powerful winds continue to rage across Los Angeles County. Officials say at least seven people have died in the blazes. The community of Altadena is just north of Pasadena and has seen some of the worst damage. Victoria Knapp is the chair of the town council. She was forced to evacuate and later lost her home in the fires.
I was able to get up to our home yesterday, which we unfortunately lost completely to the fire. I live on a cul-de-sac of 15 homes. Two were left standing. There is a lot of widespread debris from the windstorm.
Officials say between 4,000 and 5,000 structures have been damaged or destroyed. Mandatory evacuation orders remain in place for nearly 180,000 people. A federal judge has struck down an effort by the U.S. Department of Education to expand federal protections for transgender students. NPR's Corey Turner reports.
For half a century, Title IX has banned discrimination in schools based on sex. At issue in this decision is a rule the Biden administration released last spring interpreting the law to also protect sexual orientation and gender identity. The rule had been hailed by LGBTQ plus advocates, but was challenged by 26 conservative-led states that argued the president had exceeded his legal authority. In this latest ruling, a federal judge in Kentucky agreed, striking down the rule nationally and writing that it, quote, turns Title IX on its head. Before this decision, the rule had already been blocked in half the country. Corey Turner, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. A U.S. appeals court has struck down a lower court ruling that would have blocked Special Counsel Jack Smith from publicly releasing his final report on the federal cases against President-elect Donald Trump. A Trump-appointed judge in Florida had temporarily blocked the Justice Department from releasing Smith's final report, pending an emergency motion from the appeals court to block its release. In a statement, Trump argued that the charges against him are politically motivated. The Director General of the World Health Organization attended the funeral service of former President Jimmy Carter at Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral today. NPR's Gabrielle Emanuel reports Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus and Carter had been close friends for 20 years.
On a trip to Ethiopia in 2005, Carter and Tedros met for the first time. Carter went to talk about neglected tropical diseases, but Tedros, who was then Ethiopia's Minister of Health, says he wanted to discuss malaria instead.
And then the response was, you know the problem, you know the solution, and we don't want to prescribe something because we are here to support you. It was just amazing.
In the end, Tedros says Carter sent millions of bed nets to help combat malaria and then visited to help distribute the nets. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. People fleeing the Palisades fire in Los Angeles found the roads jammed with traffic. As the flames approached, some abandoned their cars, and those empty vehicles had to be pushed out of the way by a bulldozer. The Pacific Palisades has few roads in and out. That's a situation many other communities are in. And many of those communities are also lagging in evacuation planning. Lauren Sommer from NPR's Climate Desk is here to talk about the lessons from these fires. Hey there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Lauren, I mean, tens of thousands of folks have been told to evacuate in the past few days. Tell us what made this particularly challenging.
Yeah, the main thing has just been the speed of these fires. High winds made them spread incredibly fast. And, you know, that meant there was very little time to get people out. And for some people, there's still this expectation that firefighters will be able to stop it or slow it down. I spoke to Michelle Steinberg at the National Fire Protection Association about that.
California has some of the largest numbers and best trained firefighters probably in the world. Even with that, there simply are not enough people and resources to attack all these fires simultaneously and to deal with the fact that the wind is pushing them that fast. That is the reality.
And then the other problem is that some of these neighborhoods have very few ways in or out, and so the roads quickly get clogged.
Lauren, as we mentioned, there are lots of other communities that face these types of bottlenecks in evacuating. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hundreds, if not thousands, of communities in the U.S., according to experts. And as the climate gets hotter, fires are spreading faster. So if people are stuck in traffic, they're exposed to the spreading fire, and there's a real risk of losing lives. It's what happened in Lahaina, Maui, in that wildfire. It happened in the Camp Fire in 2018 in Paradise, California. Studies show that there's just this real patchwork of evacuation planning. Some communities have done a lot, but many others don't have enough financial resources.
So given all that, what should communities be doing to make sure they're able to safely evacuate folks if they need to?
Yeah, I mean, many communities are starting to use software to analyze where these choke points are. You need money to do that, of course. They're also staging evacuations. So they're going zone by zone, so there aren't too many people leaving all at once. Communities need to make sure they're using emergency text alerts, right, to send those evacuation orders. But they need other ways of getting the word out if cell service goes down. And, you know, the hardest thing to do is to create more evacuation routes by building new roads, because that often means you have to go through private property. Both Paradise, California, and Lahaina, Maui, they're looking at that right now, and it's a very slow and expensive process.
We also know, though, that evacuation, it comes down to individual choices. So what should people do to prepare?
Yeah, you know, I actually spoke to one person who evacuated the Palisades fire, and he said it was a pretty calm experience. Ryan Uliate lives in Topanga Canyon, and he had already made a checklist ahead of time about what to take so he'd be ready.
Yesterday, I went back to my checklist and took the important things out of the house, put them in the car, got in the car, and said goodbye to my house. And I'm hoping that when I return, that there will be a house there.
You know, Uliate has worked for years to help his community prepare for fires because he's part of the Topanga Canyon Fire Safe Council, which is a volunteer effort. They educate the public on how to clear vegetation to create that buffer zone around the house. And since Topanga Canyon only has one road in and out, they helped lead this project to clear the flammable vegetation along the road so it's less dangerous during an evacuation.
Our fire-prone areas are also beautiful areas, but we've realized that with that opportunity to live in a place like that comes a responsibility. And that means you've got to do more.
That's Lauren Sommer from NPR's Climate Desk with that reporting. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Protecting endangered ecosystems is usually thought of as a job for governments. Now a new financial instrument hopes to get the private sector to help out. Stan Alcorn and Tomas Uprimni take a look at biodiversity credits for NPR's Planet Money podcast.
To figure out what this new financial instrument is, we decided just to buy one.
So let's go buy a biodiversity credit.
Okay.
For $25, we could get a credit promising to protect 10 square meters of cloud forest in the Andes Mountains of Colombia, where there are 20 threatened species, including the spectacled bear.
The bear from Paddington.
Are you ready to own our own little piece of the cloud forest?
I'm ready to save Paddington.
Once we'd bought a credit...
We did it.
Done.
We wanted to see how exactly it protected biodiversity. So we had to go there, to a place called El Globo.
Are we in El Globo now? Like, this is all part
of... this is El Globo right now.
Mauricio Serna, one of the leaders of this project, takes us to see the dense jungle of the cloud forest and the traces of its most famous resident, the spectacle bear.
Wow, the scratch marks. He climbed all up over there, and you see scratches all over the tree.
This biodiverse forest is the exception here in El Globo. Most of it was cut down for cattle to graze until it was what they call clean.
And clean means no trees, no shrubs, and nothing but grass for cattle.
To turn the clean cattle ranch back into cloud forest means planting trees, putting up fences, hiring a ranger. The $25 credit we bought is supposed to help pay for all that.
Serna will eventually need to sell more than 300,000 of these credits.
That's a big inventory. So we need corporate buyers who can buy a big bunch of these credits.
The pitch to corporate buyers is a bit like voluntary carbon credits. Companies buy those to reduce carbon emissions and to make claims that they're carbon neutral.
With biodiversity credits, companies might claim they're helping nature.
It was a shot. I mean, it was like, let's try to make it work.
To see if it was working, I followed Serna to the UN Global Biodiversity Conference in Cali, Colombia. Biodiversity credits were one of the hottest topics there, with panel discussions, meetups, even a tequila company
para Pachamama
handing out shots to promote a jaguar credit.
Salud.
But there were also plenty of skeptics, like Mark Opel, a conservation finance watchdog at a group called Campaign for Nature.
We think they're a distraction.
Opel points back to voluntary carbon credits. Reports in recent years have shown the majority of credits in that market didn't actually live up to their carbon-reducing claims. He thinks biodiversity credits will have the same problems and that companies won't buy them.
At the end of the day, companies are in the business of generating shareholder value. There is not a business case for biodiversity credits to generate shareholder value beyond a token amount of philanthropy and marketing. We will never meet our goals by looking to the private sector to voluntarily make investments that don't maximize shareholder value.
By the end of the conference, Serna had talked to 30 or 40 companies, but none of them had bought biodiversity credits.
We all hoped this was the other way around, and that it was a problem of supply, not of demand, but it's just not.
He and many others now say that demand for biodiversity credits will only really grow if there are regulations or tax incentives that give companies more of a reason to buy them. In other words, the biodiversity crisis may still be a problem for governments to solve. For NPR News, I'm Stan Alcorn.
And I'm Tomás Uprimni from Bogotá, Colombia.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Surfers spend a lot of time in the water, so they have many reasons to want to keep the water pristine. But surfboards are often made of environmentally unfriendly materials. A Wisconsin-based surfer is on a quest to change that. Susan Bentz with member station WUWM has the story.
There are more than 10,000 miles of coastline along the Great Lakes, so it's often called the country's third coast. Peak season for surfing is in the fall, winter, and early spring, when winds can whip up impressive waves. So on a chilly fall morning, folks in wetsuits came to ride the swells, and Ken Cole showed up.
Here we go.
Cole's love of surfing began in Hawaii, where he was working on his psychology dissertation. There's just one problem as far as coal's concerned. Surfers love the waters, but typically use surfboards that ultimately contribute to plastic waste that can be harmful to oceans and the Great Lakes. Although there's momentum for more eco-friendly equipment, Cole says most boards have polyurethane foam cores and are coated with fiberglass, both non-biodegradable. If they break down in the water, fish and other aquatic life ingest them. If boards end up in landfills, their toxins can leach, compromising ecosystems in their path. Cole says the industry is trying to change.
But a lot of their focus is on packaging, on repurposed foam. But repurposed foam still relies on foam. Even those that are doing greener boards are still heavily relying on fiberglass.
Cole jumped aboard a movement to create surfboards that won't leave toxic waste in their wake. He started by wrapping his boards using large coffee bags made of jute, eliminating the use of fiberglass. In his basement shop, he moves boxes to show off his surfboard drawings and other creations.
This was like a flat pack box that when I lectured at one of our local schools, at the end I stood on that, basically showed that it would support the weight of a 205-pound man.
The box is strong because it's made of a composite material Cole created, a combination of jute and palm sheath. And he asked a couple of engineers to look at what he'd come up with.
Through a lot of trial and error and testing how to really prep the leaf, we figured out the right way to make the bond really strong.
The big test came on that chilly autumn morning as waves rolled across Lake Michigan. Ted Burdett, an industrial designer, was on hand to watch. He created a 3D model of the surfboard and designed the board's internal skeleton using Cole's composite material instead of foam.
It's one of the heavier boards, but I think what we're going to see is that supplies a lot of awesome momentum.
And with the waves approaching, Cole started paddling into it and then popped up on the board, riding along the face of the wave. Minutes later, when he comes back to shore, both men shout with childlike delight.
In the pocket.
Nice! That is awesome. Bring it.
Yeah.
So it works.
Cole says it's like the thrill the Wright brothers must have felt when they flew the aircraft they built near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
And this was surfing's Kitty Hawk. I truly believe that. Unless there's somebody else doing a Kitty Hawk board, which I don't think they are.
Cole won't be abandoning his psychology practice, but plans to funnel energy into inspiring other people who make surfboards or even other products to use his composite material or to come up with their own eco-friendly ideas.
If I can do it in my garage, you know, Ted shot my basement and it surfed, what else can be done? That's really the question.
Enough reflection, he says. Cole and Burdett head out to catch some waves while they last. For NPR News, I'm Susan Bentz, along Lake Michigan.
And you're listening to All Things Considered. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR Science Podcast. I'm joined by Jessica Young and Emily Kwong. Hi, y'all.
Hi. Hi.
So I know that you have brought us three science stories that caught your attention this week. What are they?
Okay, we're going to talk about how the longevity of a vaccine may be driven by our bone marrow.
And then we're going to talk about the math and science behind hula hooping.
And get a glimpse at the next year of space missions.
Okay, I want to start with vaccines because it's feeling a little germy out there, y'all. There's so much flu and COVID going around. I am very glad I'm vaccinated.
Yeah, vaccines are so powerful. They train your immune system to recognize and fight germs. And one of the ways they do so is by prompting your B cells to create antibodies. You can think of antibodies like security guards. So the COVID mRNA vaccine generates enough of an antibody response to protect against infection for 3 months and severe disease for 6 months. But other vaccines offer years-long, even lifelong, immunity.
Lifetime security, like the measles vaccine.
Yeah, exactly, or the yellow fever vaccine. And this contrast is actually what led Stanford Medicine professor Bali Pulendran to wonder, like, why? Why are some vaccines able to stimulate immunity for a few months, but others last a lifetime?
If you could understand the immunology underlying these effects, then surely we could apply that immunological insight to devising new vaccines, perhaps synthetic vaccines, that could effectively recapitulate the high degree of efficacy of this yellow fever vaccine.
And it was through this basic research question that Bali and a team at Stanford Medicine uncovered a major insight having to do with megakaryocytes.
What are those?
Okay, megakaryocytes, I'm now a fan of them. They are these big, beefy cells chilling in our bone marrow, and they're responsible for making platelets, the things that help your blood clot. But these big cells may have another role. It appears that megakaryocytes create a hospitable environment for those antibody-producing B cells to survive for years, and for the resulting antibody response to persist, almost like a pro-security guard environment. And that means that vaccines that are better able to activate megakaryocytes should stimulate immunity for a longer period of time. The team published these findings in the journal Nature Immunology this month.
Okay, so I'm curious, is there a way for future vaccines to recruit these bone marrow cells to spur a longer lasting vaccine?
Yeah, that's one possibility, right? If megakaryocytes are some kind of bellwether for measuring how well a vaccine is doing, that's useful information for doctors to know when their patient may need a booster, or for vaccine developers to estimate how long their vaccine might last. Immunology experts I spoke to, including George Lewis at the University of Maryland and Deepta Bhattacharya at the University of Arizona, see the potential. More research is required, but viral outbreaks are more likely in the future, and Bali wants us to be prepared.
It's not a question of if the next pandemic will emerge, it's a question of when the next pandemic is going to emerge.
So ultimately, Bali wants this basic research to lead to better vaccines for everyone.
Okay, y'all, that was pretty serious. Let's move on to something joyful and one of the purest sources of childhood joy. That is hula hooping.
What a pivot.
Indeed. What is the physics of keeping a hula hoop swirling around our hips?
Okay, so this research began when Leif Ristroff, a math professor at NYU, was admiring some hula hoopers at a park in New York City. And he wondered if there were any mathematical studies showing how hula hoops counteract gravity and levitate. And seeing none, he and two of his students set out to study this and learn some hula hooping themselves.
Okay, this is pretty funny, but how do you actually study this in a mathematical way?
It involves lots of mathematical modeling and physics, too. They created these little hula hooping robots using 3D printed models of different shapes. Some robots had cylinder shapes, others cones, others were hourglass-like. They wiggled all of these shapes with a tiny little hoop just under 6 inches across. These shapes, of course, were meant to represent a simplified scaled-down version of a human hula hooping.
And from watching the robot shapes and gathering data, Leif and his collaborators developed a bunch of mathematical equations and published those findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Okay, the suspense is killing me. What shapes were the best for hula hooping?
Well, all body shapes can hula hoop, but some do have an easier time, you know, keeping that hula hoop up and spinning. And the one that appeared to work the best was the hourglass shape.
Well, now I am concerned that people will think, you know, if I don't have an hourglass figure, I can't hula hoop.
No, totally. I was worried about that too. But the researchers said that you can actually just give the hula hoop more energy by moving your hips more quickly, like upping the frequency of that circular motion. Mm-hmm. And also, obviously, hula hooping isn't just for the waist. You can hula hoop on your neck or wrists or ankles.
David Hu, an applied mathematician who did not work on this project, loves how this study teaches people to hula hoop better and thinks it would be an awesome opportunity to combine PE and math courses for kids.
I love that idea. Okay, to close us out, I am so ready to hear about all of the exciting space news that I should be looking forward to this year.
Mm-hmm. We have our colleague Chandelise Duster to thank, who gathered data on all of the major missions of 2025. And there are a ton of exciting ones.
Yeah, starting as early as this month. In January, there are two missions expected to launch for the moon. One is called Resilience Mission 2, and the other is called Blue Ghost.
All right, I love the names, but what is up with these missions?
Both these missions are commercial missions, meaning they're spacecraft that are built by private companies, and they're trying to pull off moon landings. So it'll be exciting to see if they're successful. There's been a lot of recent history of commercial missions to the moon crashing or failing.
And I am assuming these are uncrewed missions?
Yeah, uncrewed. If they land, these spacecraft will also collect some scientific data, like lunar soil for testing, or they'll take photos of the lunar sunset. Mm. And the Resilience Mission 2 is going to contain food production experiments and deep space radiation monitors.
And then sometime early this year, NASA's Lunar Trailblazer will launch to look for water on the moon. For future moonwalkers, probably for splitting into hydrogen and oxygen to make rocket fuel on the moon. So this mission is going to be looking for where the water is on the moon and also the nature of it. Because there's just still a lot that we don't know, and we're going to have to find out a lot more about water on the moon if future astronauts are going to be using it for drinking water and fuel.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. That's a whole lot of moon information for me to download. So
big year for the moon.
Big year for the moon. But tell us what else is happening out there.
Well, let's see. There's also a lot of updates we'll probably get from ongoing missions, like the Proba 3 mission, which launched in December. It's trying to observe the corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, and the first results will probably be available in a few months.
And then, of course, there's the Europa Clipper. Shortwave actually reported on its launch in October. This is the mission that will be looking for evidence of whether Jupiter's moon Europa could support life. It should get there around 2030, but this March, it will get a little energy boost when it flies by Mars by using the planet's gravity to help it accelerate towards Jupiter.
It's like it's hula hooping.
That's Emily Kwong and Jessica Young from NPR science podcast Shortwave. Subscribe now for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Lana.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at Progressive Commercial.